the last time I drank during one of these, it was because a friend was very nervous. And, you know, I had a great time, and nobody's asked me to drink since. It's fine.
I don't think we're going to have a problem, Sam, by the way. I think we'll be just fine.
We'll just be fine. We'll be fine.
Yes. Yes.
All right. There he is. All right. Sit down, boo, and let's go. Come on. Sit down. Okay. Hi, fellow geochemists and geochemistry enthusiasts. Welcome to Geochemist Tea, the only podcast for people who love geochemistry with a side of tea. Our mission is to inspire and to shed light on the topics not fancy enough to talk about at a conference, but really important to delve into. I'm your host, Sam Scher, and this week we're talking with Dave Lowy about Fooled by Randomness, the Hidden Role of Chance in Life and in the Markets, an essay book by Nassim Nicholas Taleb. Dave is the Chief Geoscientist and Chief Technologist at Immidex Limited. Dave, welcome to Geochemistry.
Well, thanks very much, Sam, but I must say that I don't drink tea. I don't think I've had a cup of tea for about 20 years, but I do have something else in my hand, so we'll be just fine. I think we're safe.
Yeah, I think we're safe. And first things first, to those that haven't listened to the podcast before but are just so excited that we're talking to Dave that they decided to listen in, tea is American slang for gossip, so this has nothing to do about drinking tea. And Dave has also requested that we have a little something. So while Dave is being classy with his red wine, it's 8 a.m. here, and I am having what was in the house, which would be a vodka soda. So good morning and good afternoon, everybody.
Sorry, Sam.
It's fine. I thought it would be worse than it is, and I don't know what that says about me. So, Dave, your career has spanned from oil and gas to mining and in-house geochemist, and then to consulting and to guiding geochemistry technology. What more can you tell us about your career and how you started out and how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, that's a very good question, Sam, but one that's quite difficult to answer. I'll just say a few things about it, and that is that it's been largely non-linear. We're here talking about randomness, et cetera, and there's been an element of that in my career. There's no doubt. But one thing I will say in hindsight and looking back on it is that in my experience of life, at least, there's no such thing as useless information. You know, starting out many years ago, decades ago now, those who know me know that I'm getting on a bit. But I started out in engineering, then we did a trade in the oil industry, which is sort of ironic and weird. Then went to university, done a lot of work in geophysics, then a lot of work in geochemistry, a complete melange of stuff. But to this day, sitting here 30, 35 years, 40 years later, perhaps, after looking back at all of that, in a weird way, I can look back and say there's not one thing I've done in my life which is not useful to me today. And that goes right back to my semi-failed attempt at engineering and my first business deal to get out of the school without it having written against my academic record, through to doing the trade in, ironically, instrumentation and electronics, and now work for a company that provides and makes and designs instrumentation electronics for geology and geoscience, which is a true irony, I think, and who would have even thought that? And I think, in a way, when we get into this discussion, we're talking about randomness and how things happen and ascribing causation to things. I think sometimes you shouldn't get too carried away with it and just go with the flow, but just make sure you're learning along the way. The latter half of all of that, I suppose, is the more entrepreneurial side of what I've done over my lifetime. Like, I threw in a completely fantastic corporate career job at Anglo American, for example, to go and do a startup with my friend Stephen Winter at the time, 12, 20 years ago, almost now. And why do that as well? Well, yeah, I always had an entrepreneurial itch. in a strange way, reading this book filled by randomness. If I'd read it before I'd done it, mate, would I have done it? Is actually a very good question, because hindsight's 100%, and I think we'll touch on this later on. And looking back at what I've done, it's worked out well for me. There's no doubt. Was there any guarantee it would have worked out well? No. Could I have written a book on why it did work out well? I possibly could, but it would be a complete and utter bullshit. Anyway, we can touch on that later on, Sam.
I like that. I'm going to write down, and I've only had a few sips, so touch on utter BS, because I'm only a few sips in and we have some children maybe listening to this, but touch on other bullshit about the startup success. I think that does lead into one of, or many of, the questions that we have for this. I will say, guys, as we start out, I asked people to, you know, look at an article, and Dave asked me to read a book, which was completely nonlinear, and how it proceeded as well. More of like chain of thought. So I respected that, because that's how I think, but it was a little bit hard to follow. But we'll continue later. That said, and I like how you talk about how everything that you went through was pretty nonlinear and not necessarily planned out, I feel, to an extent, because I graduated in not quite a mining boom. So my journey also has been very nonlinear. Looking back on it, it might seem a little bit linear, but I would say to the audience, if you look at my LinkedIn profile, it definitely wasn't linear, and it was also very stressful. So it's a good thing, guys, to keep in mind that you can't always make sense out of how your career progresses, particularly in geology. So thanks for that. And just to finalize this little piece out, Dave, we're talking about how your career is pretty nonlinear, but do you have any tips or advice to give our listeners that want to pursue geochemistry?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Do it if you're interested in it, would be my short advice. But a little bit more around that, you'll need to do some sort of specialization. Just a good undergraduate course is necessary, of course, but you would need to do some sort of a postgraduate specialization. Do your maths. I know that's anathema to many people who do geoscience, but really do your maths, pay attention to mineralogy and all forming system studies and fundamental chemistry, because if you go into something like geochemistry and geophysics and some of the other specialties, the process is all important, and it really talks about what we're going to talk about in this podcast. And that is, if you don't have some sort of an understanding of the underlying process, the scientific causation of things, then it's very easy to be misled by data if you don't have some sort of fundamental basis for looking at it. And you just must have that. And then another thing, which is sort of a lesson, because I did not do this as part of my university training at all, but if you're going to get into geochemistry, assaying, and then that segues somewhat into resource estimation, things like that, if you get a chance earlier on in your career, if you're sponsored by a large mining company or even a small one, if you can go off and do a course on sampling theory, sounds boring, but I can guarantee you it's not. And if you understand sampling theory, the requirements for everything you're sampling to have an equiprobable chance of ending up into whatever it is you're sending to the lab from a geochemical point of view, then that is all important, and that will help you avoid many pitfalls later on when you're interpreting your data. That was something I learned on the job later on, so to speak.
I've never heard of a sampling theory offered in a geology faculty. Any ideas where we get one?
Yeah, they're typically, well, they're not even postgraduate things. That they would be professional development courses, I would think. And I think there's a few people have run them over the years. You know, for instance, Petard and Bongarson, people like that have been around forever running those courses. But there are other people, the SRKs and AMCs and consultancies in your part of the world, Sam, would run these. They run from a resource estimation point of view and sampling to avoid bias in resource estimation and grade estimation. But you can take the thought processes a bit like this book and apply them to many other things.
That's some really good advice, and I hope that everybody took something away from that. So thank you. Switching over, and I don't know if I need to re-explain to you, Dave, here, but it's not...
I think I've got it now.
Okay, yeah. It's definitely not the tea that you drink that we're looking for. Key to this, I think, would be sitting in like a hair salon and hearing for the first time, coming back from South America, girl, what's the tea? Like, excuse me? You know, what are we talking about here? Yeah, tea is gossip. For flavor, like we talked about really, I guess at this point, only a few minutes ago, but Teenatics, Dave's chosen a classic glass or two of red, and I've chosen my vodka soda. We only started just chatting 20 minutes ago, so perhaps we don't require too much editing in this section, but feel free to just, you know, train a thought, as many F-bombs as you need, but please spill the tea, because now it's tea time.
All right. I did have a little bit of a think about this, because now it's my chance to tell some stories about other people rather than the other way around.
The spirit.
The spirit of it. And there'll be a few people, I think, listening in that might be sucking in a bit of breath right now, but I'll be nice. So a couple of the people you've interviewed already, so Pim Van Geffen and Mike Whitbread. So Pim, of course, was always the Piminator in my mind, which is a relatively nice nickname. But Mike Whitbread...
I think he still is the Piminator. I think he thinks of himself that way. Yeah.
It's a Piminator, yeah. So it's it's turned into an unintended compliment for him, which would be very typical of Pim.
Yes.
He would wear it as like a badge of honor.
He would. If he could have a cape, he would have one. Yeah. Okay.
Then we have Mike Whitbread. Now Whitbread has an unofficial nickname.
Oh, boy.
Huge.
Do we want to know?
No.
Okay. But we do. Continue.
No, it's not possible. It's not possible to explain it on a podcast that could be heard by virtually anyone apart from about three people on the planet.
Awkward.
Awkward, yes. So I would recommend that anyone who knows Mike immediately contacts him on LinkedIn or messaging or something and asks him how he came to have the nickname Huge. And he'll have to fess it up now, which I think is fantastic.
Okay.
Oh, boy.
All right, second note of the day. MW, in quotes, Huge. I mean, I don't know if I want to go there, but I kind of do. Continue.
It may not be what you think. That's the only thing I'm saying.
Everybody that knows me knows it's just like, oh my God, she's thinking of one thing and I'm trying not to. Yeah, okay. Let's go.
I've got a few other anecdotes. So as you know, in our global days, there were a lot of us there. And it was, we're going back a while now. There were different times, even 15 years ago were different times in the day. But at that point in time, I did employ a lot of extremely bright and talented female geochemists in the group, which was not that normal at the time. And in fact, I got asked it a few times, why do you employ all these people? And I said, well, because they're very smart and bright and ambitious and good. And they said, oh, well, they may get pregnant. I said, well, shock horror. How about that? Anyway, but because we had quite a unique blend of staff in the company, we had a few rules when we were out.
This is not sounding good.
Oh, no, I think you'll find it's pretty funny. Okay. When I was out with the staff, they were coached to only have one drink for every two of my drinks to stay out of trouble, just for a start. That was just for a start. They had to instigate a bit like the Marines, that no one gets left behind strategy when we're all out drinking. Safety, unless one wanted to be left behind, which is a completely different thing, of course. And that used to happen occasionally as well with the group. That was right.
If there's friends at conference, you want to be left behind. You want to hang out with your bros. I get it.
Yes, that sort of thing. Yep.
Yes.
I'm not naming any names here, but...
I hear what you're saying. Continue.
Yeah. Me sitting in front of my computer in the office one day, and then back then the fax machine was hooked up to email.
Excellent.
So whenever a fax arrived, I would get an email just saying what was in the fax. And some of them was out getting some sort of a pregnancy-related test, and the results were faxed in. And, of course, this was all top secret at the time. And then so I got the fax at the same time as the fax came in, and that created a little bit of pandemonium in the office as well. It was all fun, right? This was all fun at the time. I had one of our staff members, in fact, I'll name this one, Britt, actually.
She was going to come up at some point.
She was going to come up at some point. But Britt, this is ages ago at Roundup in Vancouver, to get a job, dragged me out of the conference and sat me at a seat out there. We were down, at the time, the conference was down at the Western. And she sat there talking to me until I think I was dying of hypothermia. I can't remember which way around it is now, hypo or hyperthermia. Anyway,
hypo.
Virtually hypothermia almost got me to the point of death until I'd actually offer her a job. And then she would let me stop talking to me and let me get back into the conference. Anyway, but these are all fun things.
Guys, this is a strategy for those that are listening. Here's a good strategy, especially all you Canadians out there. All right. I like this.
And of course, there would be one or twice where we'd been out running multi-day workshops for companies in various parts of the world and may have arrived back at the hotel at 5:30 or 6 in the morning to start the next day. Teaching. But anyway, but that's just the way it goes. And in fact, though, we're not going to talk about this other Nicholas Taleb book, but anti-fragility, I think, is another concept, which is a good one, which should permeate many people's thinking. So, yeah, do all that stuff. But if you're an anti-fragile, you'll get back up and keep going and see the day out. Sort of a bit old-fashioned as well, right? If you're gonna play out and be an idiot, make sure you turn up to work and execute and get the job done. Old dotard type advice.
I just hear this on so many levels. I don't know who is supposed to be the story that, other than I just heard in there, Britt keeping you out until she got a job. That, I really like that strategy. I am a little bit upset that Britt didn't ever share this with me, because I went through my own struggles throughout the early 2010s and everything, and that would have been some advice I wanted to know. So I'm glad that we now have this advice, and I really appreciate that.
So Heidi Pass took me out for a coffee when I was still living in Vancouver. This is a long time ago. And asked me what she should do with her life. And I said, well, you should finish your PhD on this, that, and the other. And then when I got to Australia, she sent me a nice letter saying thank you. And then I got an email asking for a job about 6 or 7 years later, going, Dave, so I went here, I did this, I did my PhD, blah, 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 now I'm ready. And I'd forgotten, of course.
I love that. Oh, my.
Yeah.
It's funny, too, that you mentioned whatever it was, the early 2010s of you guys having early mid 2010s having such a diverse workforce and you didn't need to have it at the time. I'll say that I've worked for a provider, too, and it was in the late 2010s and we were so heavily female and every conference that was remarked upon. And now BHP has their 50-50 and there's other companies that are instituting things to try and become more diverse or whatever their KPI is for it. But I remember that just being shocking even at that point, which I guess Gen Z hadn't really risen to the forefront at that point. But yeah.
Well, I mean, that's a whole other podcast, really, but that's just better. Yeah. It's just better, right? It just makes for a better work environment when it's more diverse.
Yeah, we're definitely not here for a diversity podcast. That's not who we are. We're just like, let's listen to some tea. Let's talk about some geochem. Look, guys, I'm not sure how this discussion, the next one's going to go in terms of talking about geochemistry. But like I said earlier, we're going to talk about this book, which has to do with the stock market and this man's feelings on it. It was a little bit sinuous, but in the end, I got to the finish line. we'll just say. So I got a bunch of requests to have Dave on the show. Not that I wouldn't have thought of you myself. It's just I had some significant requests piling up in my inbox. I said, okay, all right, we got to pursue this. I always also thought that we would meet up somewhere over the past year to properly discuss a topic and also just to talk about keeping the reading amount manageable. But after failing to meet up again at PDAC this year, we had a little chat online. And after poking some fun at some of my other guests that requested that I read book chapters and siren parts, I think we're going back to the huge Mike Whitbread on this one. Dave looked me point blank in the face and said, hey, you should read this book. Challenge accepted. I went to read about the stock market and Taleb's philosophies on randomness. So thank you for that, Dave. To start, could you summarize some of the key points of the book and why you think it's a must read for a geochemist and for that matter, geoscientists in general?
Yeah. So sorry for giving you a book to read, Sam. In the various workshops I've run over the years, I've mentioned this book, and many people have read it and come up to me afterwards to comment on it and saying, I'm so thankful that you recommended that I read that book, because it has nothing to do with geoscience.
Nothing.
At least at face value, nothing, like zero to do with
geoscience. Zero.
But when I talk to people, I often say that it should be a requirement in every undergraduate geoscience degree should be to read this book. Especially for geoscience, not just for geoscience, but it just makes you think. And I love things that make you think. There's another good one as well that I often talk to people about, which I didn't inflict on you because I couldn't give you two books to read. But that one's Sorting the Signal from the Noise by Nate Silver. That's also a good book. At least that one has one chapter on predicting earthquakes, for example. There's some tenuous connection to geoscience. But look, randomness, signal and noise, I think these are concepts that all geoscientists need to think about because we seek rare events. And so when you're seeking a rare event, i.e. trying to find an ore deposit, it makes you really susceptible to quackery, if I want to call it, or fake science. You know, if we're in the exploration game, we're born optimists, we're glass half full people. So we want to, you know, and this is a quote from one of Nate Silver's books, actually, we want to imbue the data with a positive meaning. That's our natural bias, which is another thing we'll talk about. And that's our natural bias. And geoscientists are also very visual. We're sort of self-selecting for the visual side of our science, another bias. So when you take the fact we're looking for rare events, we're optimists, and we're very visual when we look at data, it can lead us to over-interpret data, overfit it in our own minds, and to come to a conclusion. Now, if you read this book, this, although it doesn't talk about any of that particularly, it will give you great pause for thought around what really is the causation. Is there any causation whatsoever? Is what I'm seeing just random noise? And we see a lot of fucking random noise in exploration. Not to put too fine a point on it.
If I learned one thing from this book, it's to not look for causation, I would say, that there is no cause.
Well, I was reading some of your comments, which we'll get to later on. That could be a little bit nihilistic, but just a little bit nihilistic. You know, sometimes there is a cause. You know, there has to be a cause in what we see, but is it what we're looking for is the better question.
Good point. A bit unlike my usual style, I've decided to have the Q&A here as a collection of some of the philosophies or examples that I jotted down while reading the book. I'm not going to apologize necessarily that these may or may not be questions, because we did read a book on philosophy, so I'm just going to leave them hanging. But hopefully,
very dense book as well.
Oh my goodness, I can't. But hopefully these are just some starting points for our discussion and something for people that are listening to interact with us a bit offline about. So let's talk about first about survivorship basis. To my teen addicts, And I am trying out this word. This was suggested to me by a listener. Let me know how you guys feel about teen addict as those that are following the podcast. This is a concept that we see in quotes winners and then try to learn from them while forgetting about the huge number of losers. I think this is particularly applicable to our industry, and I'd like to get into this. Did this concept also speak to you, Dave?
Oh, very much so. So before we get to geochemistry and exploration, the bit I really liked, being an entrepreneur and starting a business myself, was the anecdotes he constantly uses around things like when you go into the bookshop and there's how I made it, you know, the five steps that I do this to get that, the X habits of, you know, people who are slightly crazy and turn out to be successful. You know, the people who write the books are the people who are successful. And of course, if you turn that into a scientific argument, which we forget, and that is, where's the proof that everyone else has followed exactly those steps aren't equally successful, right? And there is none, because it's just it's fatuous. It's a furphy. It's an Australian word for the same thing. They're just lucky in many aspects. So you can do, and if you run a business yourself, you know, you can do everything perfectly by the book and be a miserable failure, or you can do everything perfectly by the book and be a runaway success. There's something else going on. And part of it is luck. There's no doubt, right? And there's another
thing. Or your charm.
Or your charm. Charm, luck. But yeah, I can tell you, even in IO days, right? You know, the micro can't overcome the macro. So if you can be doing a brilliant job on the micro scale with your own business, but if the global economy tanks, then you're at the complete and utter mercy of the global economy. And that can be absolutely ruinous for people. I think I said in another podcast, you're running a small company, just you and a mate and 20 or 30, 40, 50 people, even 100 people with a successful business. You only need to go to the doctor once and get a bad outcome to completely affect yourself and the rest of the business. So this is this randomness thing that goes on. I mean, the randomness can be difficult to understand, but there are strategies around it to help you cope with it, if you like. But when we extend the everyone that wins writes the business book analogy, we take that into our own industry and exploration and even academia. I actually found the statistics, and something like 95 or 98% of all academic papers that are published are reporting a success. I'll put in quotes, a success. So what it means is that things that fail aren't being reported. So again, it's the same. We end up with this same bias in the public domain literature that we read. We think that all of these researchers go out and seek funds and do things and come out with a publishable, successful outcome, which has led to some pretty dodgy things being published over the time, there's no doubt. But really, you learn just as much from someone publishing something that says, we tried this, we tested this, it was a miserable bloody failure, our theory was wrong. There's as equal validity to publishing, admittedly, a well-designed experiment that was testing a theory that didn't work. That is equally valid to publish that something tested a theory that did work. And they should both be given equal weighting and representation in the literature. Where we see it come through into our own industry in exploration is everyone wants to talk about the successes, but no one wants to talk about the failures, of course. So how many of those successes are the same thing? It was just sheer shit ass luck, to put it in Australian, that you're in a certain place at a certain time and did something and, oh my God, found something. Oh my God. And then we reverse engineer it to being a perfectly executed, scientifically designed exploration program, which was successful. You know, there's quite a bit of that in the industry, but, you know, I don't want to take the fun out of exploration either, right? So there's always an element of serendipity in our industry. You have to be an optimist to work in exploration because the likelihood of true success is so low. And there also has to be an element of serendipity. But I think one of the elements of not being fooled by randomness and anti-fragility, another Nicholas Taleb thing, is if you know that, then you can at least put all of the conditions together so that if something happens or you find something or see something or some piece of information passes through your desk, that you recognize it for what it is and can act on it. So another element of this being filled by randomness is actually submitting to it and doing nothing, right? This is sort of a negative aspect of it. Many people, and this applies in exploration as well, many people watch things go past them but don't understand what they're seeing. So there are things you can put in place to increase your odds of success, right? To actually find something, actually do something significant, put everything in place so that if something happens and you see it, you recognize it. And if 99 out of 100 people don't recognize it, but you do, oh my God, that increases your chance of success many times over.
Yeah, I think I have two stories there. The first being one that McLean Trott shared on the show where it was a bit of tea that he had grabbed from somebody else, and I forget the company in the Copper Belt, but basically one of the Project Geos or whoever was conducting the drilling program had gotten shit-faced the night before, and then the guy on the rig drilled the other way, and they had their big discovery, right? There's that, and the other one I think of is more to your last point, whereby there's this really great deposit up in northern Peru, and everybody before Regulus had picked it up, they were just looking at really just the skarn and the surficial advanced argillic epithermal system up there and not paying attention to some of the deeper holes that had been drilled. And after talking with the chief geo on the project, one of the things that just grabbed him immediately was just what was brought up from below in the breccias. And that's why they picked up the project. So,
No, that's really important. You can set yourself up to be successful just by putting the bits and pieces in place. Doesn't mean that right piece of information will come past you, but you need to be in the best place position to recognize it when it does, because so many other people aren't.
Yeah. All right. So another thing that immediately grabbed my attention was that we as humans tend to view the world as more explainable than it really is and look for explorations where there really is none. So can you relate this to your experience in geochem?
Yeah, this is another big topic in his book, isn't it? So when I think about this, I'm like, well, humans have been explaining the world for thousands of years. I've said here a very long time. So we have an inbuilt bias to want to explain what's going on around us, whether we actually know what's going on or not. But as time has moved on and as science has advanced, and sometimes, well, explanations have increased in scientific validity, of course, and so we've overturned some things that people have generally understood to be real for hundreds and hundreds of years. Still doesn't mean it goes completely smoothly with, for example, 5G causing COVID and Bill Gates being injected into all the rest of it. So we don't all necessarily come along for the journey. But the thing is that, and this is something I often think about, is the way information has been and learnings have been handed down through human history by telling stories, right? We like to tell each other stories as a way of preserving knowledge, and then especially before we got to the being able to, with the written word, tell stories and look at things and interpret it. So we have a really natural bias to want to explain things and tell stories about them, is what I'm trying to say here, I think. So if we look at something in it from a geochemical point of view, and it just looks like a whole bunch of data with some stuff going on, if we look at it long enough, we'll find something in it that's interesting. And then if we look at it long enough and find something that's interesting, we'll probably explain it. We'll come up with some reason to explain it and probably think that it's actually a pretty good answer as well. Sometimes we need to just stand back and think, yeah, man, does that really mean anything or not? You know, I've seen lots of orientation studies done over the years where especially in the early days of multi-element geochemistry or the partial leaches and things like that, where you could run a line of soil samples across something and get 50 or 60 analytes back, and something would respond somewhere on that orientation line or on that grid. And you'd think it might be significant, but if you stand back and go, exploring for zinc here, do I really think that, you know, a hafnium anomaly is significant if I'm exploring for zinc because it happens to go up over the projected, over the surface projection mineralization? That's a pretty awful analogy, but it happens, right? And so there's the other thing. If we collect enough data, something will be perturbed or look a bit weird in the area of interest, and then we just generate for ourselves a whole bunch of false positives, things which are positive, which don't make much sense. We can't explain them. We have no process that we can explain them either. But nonetheless, if they're there, then we feel compelled to follow them up. That's another thing, another bias. We can't let them go, right? We get the fever. We see a big red blob on the map, but no, we can't explain it. Now, I think, well, I don't know, but I think some of that stuff's dropped out of the geochemical industry, at least the last 5 or 10 years, maybe it's the last downturn. But the other way I talk to people about this and trying to mitigate getting caught up in it is I regard exploration as being an experiment, basically a scientific experiment. And so it comes down to the design of experiments. So you should design the exploration program to provide the most diagnostic answer to the question you posed for it in the shortest amount of time, at the least amount of cost, at the least cost. So thinking, you know, before you go out and do something, think about, what am I going to do with that data? What am I looking for? What am I going to see to it? How do I know if what I'm looking for is there or not with the data I collect? Am I going to go, there was something that's so unproven, I'm just going to generate a whole bunch of data and give me false positives to chase until the cows come home and just keep me distracted on this exploration property for no good reason? And there, but that's a really, it's an easy question to pose of something. It makes them think, people think, but it's not an easy question to answer within a budget and a time frame and logistical constraints as well.
Yeah, that's such a great point to bring up. I find myself right now in the middle of an orientation program, and I think the other thing I would add to that is, depending on your survey, depending on what you're doing, having the flexibility, not necessarily to change the entire parameters of your thinking, but to rise to the occasion when you have certain things that you didn't expect pop up. In this case, right now, it's just completely logistical and just trying to change a little bit of parameters to fit what's going on and things that you didn't expect. But I think that's such a good point. And economics also do matter. Economics, time, they matter.
The constraints aren't purely scientific, right? But season, can you get access? There's all of that sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
Yeah. And sometimes I talk to people and say, well, rather than mucking around, well, mucking around is the wrong word, but rather than doing a whole lot of stuff, which could be involved many different things, is perhaps the best idea just to get out there and drill a hole. And I know that sounds a little bit, you know, kind of cyclical to what I've been talking about, but and a bit to the serendipity thing, that there's one, there are not many guaranteed outcomes in exploration, but one of them is, if you don't drill a hole, you're not going to find anything. So we can, and this is the balance involved here, so you can overthink things as well. I mean, this is it's a difficult industry, right? Balancing all of these negatives and positives and thought processes and balancing the sheer amount of stuff we don't know in three dimensions. So here's another thing, right? We deal in three dimensions. This is something that's not appreciated outside of geoscience and mining typically. It's just an amazing dimension. And I think there's some questions later on about machine learning and stuff. Most people that come out of the data world think about time series or very well constrained data. But you take all that stuff and you apply it to the third dimension, or to spatial dimension, volumes. Most people can't cope with it. They really can't.
I would say also, because now I'm just going to build on everything you say, but probably not. But in this case, too, you drill a hole. I would say, too, to our listeners in particular, that just because you don't intersect mineralization doesn't mean that your data is meaningless. And to make sure that you've just spent $500,000 to $1 million drilling this hole, make sure that you take all the information that you can gather and apply it in a meaningful way. I've watched people that have drilled holes like, there's no copper in here. And then they've just left. They sent all the stuff to assay. They collected MagSess. They collected a whole suite of data. And it just sits there because they didn't see any visible copper. They saw no more than, I think in this case, it was 500 ppm. But it's like, well, hold on here. That's more than background. So I'm not saying that there's going to be a deposit here. I'm just saying that to a degree, this is anomalous. So let's try and see what we can get out of this one or two holes. So I would throw that out there for our listeners as well.
Well, hallelujah. How do we know what's anomalous if we don't know what the hell background is? And often we don't know what the hell background is in the first place.
Yeah.
How can we measure the deviance of our hole from background, if you like, if we don't know what that is?
You know, pretty soon I'm going to be done with this vodka soda. I'm going to just be on the amen train. So we got our tea, we got our amen train. I mean, there's oh my goodness. So look, throughout the book, the author talks about probability as having a large role in his analysis of the world and markets. I've used probabilities besides in uni, which I don't want to get into. I'm just going to say hashtag Russell Steele. You know, now that I've named him, I've never sat in a class before where the professor has told his students that it's not okay for them to hit on him. And I don't know if he just went through some really bad stuff or he was just that vain. But I was sitting there being like, what? Like, this is the weirdest thing that I've ever been through. But anyway, moving on. Again, the vodka made me speak.
What did he say? what weren't you allowed to do?
We weren't allowed to hit on him.
Oh, that's what I thought you said.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
We'll be in trouble with this podcast, realize.
Oh my goodness. Okay. Yeah. Probability, large role in his analysis of the world of markets. Look, I've used probabilities lately, working on some machine learning models, looking for type 1 and type 2 errors. But overall, I freely admit to not integrating it overall in a daily or even a project workflow. So how important do you think it is to consider probability when working with geochem data?
Yeah. I read this. Of course, you've sent this question to me, and I've grappled with it. Probability is an interesting concept when looking at geochemical and geological data, because if you're going to talk in probabilities have books and books of assumptions behind them to make them rational and useful, most of which geochemical data break the fuck out of, to put it in French. So
je parle pas.
So when I read this one, my brain sort of went into a bit of bloody mind lock, actually. And you need to remember, I have a team of data scientists that work for me as well.
Yes, you do. Right?
So they deal with this stuff every day.
You also acquired another company.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, they do it for you. Okay.
Yeah, so I think probability based answers doesn't release us from common sense, if that makes sense. If a probabilistic based method tells us something and we go, well, I think that's bullshit, or I can't explain that. Well, you need to think about that, right? Because there are many things, right? That there's overfitting, there's shit in, shit out, there's parametric and non-parametric techniques, there's the condition of your input data suffering from a multitude of problems like closure and censuring and distribution problems and different ranges and centering and all the rest of it, right? Any number of those things, singly or in combination, can confound many of these machine learning techniques. And yeah, you can summarize that as shit in, shit out, as people do. The only thing I've got to say about that is I'm not saying that these techniques won't work with geoscience, geochemical data, but the people doing them need to be informed by people with domain knowledge. It's really, I can't emphasize that enough, actually. And to extend that, apart from the unique nature of some of the input data, there's the other thing where we're liable to throw machine learning people data of utterly different scale, but it still looks like chemical data to the people you've thrown it at. So you might throw them, or they might get thrown in a company without necessarily being explained to them, a mineral chemistry, a sample of like some mineral chemistry from a sample that represents 100 square kilometer catchment, or some mineral chemistry that represents one mineral in a piece of drill core. Right. Now, to the machine learning people, these look like just mineral chemical data. But if they don't understand that, if no one's actually explained to them the difference between them, then the interpretation of them is utterly, utterly different. And the implications of what you would do is what you might find out from them. They're linked, of course, but it's the other unique thing about our data is it's attached to different. We spoke about volumes before, but geochemical data, the things you give to people to work with, can be attached with processes that have affected minute parts of the Earth's crust through to giant parts of the Earth's crust, and they've imposed themselves on pre-existing rocks and then been further modified themselves. When you roll all of that together, you can't just give that to machine learning people without and have them give you some probabilistic based answer without some guidance from someone who knows what's going on. That sounds a bit negative, but I do use these. They're all caveats, right? I do and have and like using a lot of these things myself, but I'll come back to the design of experiment, like running an exploration program, it's a design of experiment, throwing these sorts of AI, ML, whatever you like at a problem, is also a design of experiment. And if it's not designed properly, it won't give a rational outcome.
Yeah. And I think that comes back to why you would have those type one, type two answers, right? Because you have to start with a question before you even start doing any kind of model. And that's how you know if you failed, you've passed, if it was a false positive, false negative. So, yeah.
You need an understanding, you know, to go back to just if you want to be a geochemist, it's the process. Having fundamental knowledge of your mineralogy, of your chemistry, a little bit of maths, things like that, understanding the fundamentals allows you to elucidate an answer out of problematic data. But if you don't understand the fundamental process, if you don't have your own explaining power in your head, you can't evaluate what the models will throw at you. Unless, of course, you throw it into ChatGPT or a large language model, but that would be another.
That's another thing.
It is another thing.
We would love to see how it performed with geologic data. We'll see.
Yeah.
So,
just on that.
Okay, we're there, so keep going.
We're there. You got me just sort of related to the question we were just talking about, but there was one thing I was listening to someone talking about large language models, which I thought was really quite profound, and I thought I'd try it out in this audience. So if someone gives you a mobile phone and it's not working, you can take it to an engineer and say, it's not working, give it to someone. They can explain to you how the mobile phone works, and if you do this, do that, how the components work, put one thing in, get another thing out, it's all fine. Same with most programming. Large language models, these GPT systems, are the first time humanity's actually developed something where we can't actually explain what's coming out the other side. That's profound.
That is profound.
It is profound. That it's given
profound for 9 a.m.
Well, for a Monday. Let's just say for a Monday, it's profound.
Yeah.
So no one can actually answer as it's advancing, how it's coming out with what it's coming out with, which I think is interesting and alarming at the same time. But then if you take that a bit further, the superheroes in Silicon Valley, they're all a bit crazy anyway, but they give these things a non-trivial chance of wiping out the human race. And then you can extend that discussion to why would humans actually work on something with a non-trivial chance of wiping ourselves out? Anyway, we digress.
We digress. I mean, I feel like we've all watched Terminator 1 through 8, so we know it's coming. Okay, profound. Thank you, Sam.
Yes. All right. Come on, Sam. Off we go. Keep it together. So, we're good.
So perhaps most central to your recommendation of reading this book would be the comparison to if you were to look at your stock portfolio daily, we would observe mostly noise rather than actual returns. Similarly, you counsel in many of your talks and courses to sort the signal from the noise. Could you talk about both this phenomenon and how this book impacted your thinking on the matter?
Yeah, so I'll do this in reverse a bit. So the way I've thought about exploration for a long time, I found the book reinforced, if that makes sense.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy. And it comes back to the design of experiments. So signal to noise and randomness. You want to calm down. I mean, there's a randomness in all scientific data, just precision and accuracy, but just the precision thing, there's a randomness in everything. And we can measure it, but there's also a signal. And we can design our exploration programs to minimize the noise and enhance the signal. So minimize the randomness in what we do with that data. It all comes back to the design. But to get the design right to amplify the signal and minimize the noise means you need to understand the process that you're looking for. So it becomes a circular thing. If you understand the process, then you can design a program to go and look for it. If you just go and do something because your boss wants you to go and do something, you'll end up with a bunch of data you can see stuff in but have no idea what the hell it means. Right? Now, the serendipity thing is you might go and do something and drill a hole through 10 meters of 10% zinc or something and go, well, you don't need much signal to noise to work that out. But it's everything else apart from the bleedingly obvious where this becomes important. And I'll come back to the fact, what is, you know, signal and noise? What is a signal? What's a signal? How do you know what the fuck a signal is if you don't know what background is? Right. So sometimes an exploration program, the most meaningful hole you can drill, and some exploration managers will bloody choke on their tea, coffee, wine, beer, whatever, is something completely misses everything, right? And then you learn something. I've over the years worked on many exploration programs and said, can we please just drill a stratigraphic hole, as you call it, just a hole that goes through and it says, what the hell are the rocks here? Where are we? What do they look like when they've not been done over by various processes? How do we know if we're near to something, apart from going right through it, if we don't know what the background looks like? And to your case, where 500 ppm copper, maybe that's background over, you know, hundreds of square kilometers, in which case you go, you know, fair enough. But this sort of background here is such that signal is spread all over the place. So that is background. I've learned something. So if I'm looking at signal to noise ratio, I need something that's above 500 ppm copper. Now, 500 is a bit high, but, you know, 100, 150, that sort of thing. Some regions, they are the background levels of copper. But if you don't understand that they're the background, you don't understand the significance. So you might think it's significant and keep drilling, right? You can turn the logic one way or the other, but it's just understanding what is the baseline you're dealing with.
It's such a good point. And probably, yeah, the least exciting, least well-received thing that you could offer up as a suggestion.
Yeah. I'm not suggesting that a graduate geo goes out to the exploration manager and says, I want to go away from the target 20 kilometers and drill a hole. Now, not at all. But if you think it through, there's probably a hole over there somewhere, which might be held in a repository somewhere.
Yeah.
That you can go along and get hold of, perhaps depending where you are in the world, and go into that core shed and get hold of that and reassay yourself at a fraction of the cost of drilling it. And that would be very valuable information.
I love it.
There are a number of ways of coming at these problems.
Just got to, you know, Just got to be resourceful.
Yes, that's right.
So building on this last question, another theme that the author returns to over and over again is the benefits of hindsight bias. And we talked about this a bit before. And in this, events look less random than they actually were. So can we be a bit more specific and apply this concept specifically to exploration geochemistry? How in hindsight we craft compelling stories about something such as a discovery?
This is an old chestnut. When something gets found, I mean, even if there's been a systematic scientific exploration process followed, who found the ore deposit, right? Even when you find something. You know, the greatest risk, I always look at exploration, I think the greatest risk is, by far and away with what we do, is area selection, is the initial area selection. Where will we look for whatever it is we want to find? So the people who make that choice, which could be at a scale which is inappropriate for detailed exploration, but then there's follow-up work, there might be some airborne geophysics, some surface sampling, blah, 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 you eventually zone into onto something. And someone finally drills a hole and hits something and they found something, you know, that was success. How on earth do you ascribe that to an individual, to a group? You know, it's very difficult, right? Yeah, perhaps in the more olden days, if someone spent 3 weeks on a donkey over the back of the Andes to collect a stream sediment in the middle of nowhere and actually turned up, so you might go, oh, okay, you're right. Fair enough. But that area selection step is absolutely all important in exploration. But look, you know, I've not looked at the stats, how many of the discoveries in the last, well, the discovery rate's falling, of course, but in the last 30 years, of what you'd call serendipity, you know, I'm even Sandfire here, we're out looking for laterite gold and bogged their last drill hole in native copper, you know, and turn themselves into a copper company. Things that our industry is replete with stories like that, which you can be a quantitative as you like, but always resonate in the back of my mind. And I come back to that thing: you're not going to find anything unless you go and drill a hole. And it's this balance, right? You can talk yourself out of doing the work, out of drilling the hole. Don't know enough. Well, you know, you've done everything possible, rational. Go and drill a hole. You know, just see what's there, see what's going on. I mean, there's got to be some reason why we're here looking in this area. But there's never, you know, there's really one thing that led to a discovery. I think there's normally a multitude or a multiplicity of reasons for why the company is where it is, doing what it's doing. Lots of people contribute to that process. Thank goodness.
I think that's a really good point, how it's definitely a team game at this point. And mistakes.
It's a team game, right? Yeah. And even who motivated for the budget in the first place to go there to do the work? Right? Who raised the funds? Who, you know, the smart money men talking to the investors gone out there and drummed up the cash to, you know, get people to buy the shares, to bring the money in, to go, yeah. It just goes the whole without, you know, it's a bit like in an odd way, and I've just thought of this actually, a bit like a safety incident. If it's a whole chain of events, and if you break one of them, then the incident doesn't happen. It's a bit like exploration. If you break one of those chains in that event process, then you never get to the point of actually doing the bit that finds you the ore deposit.
I'm there with you.
It's a complex discussion. And I know, having worked for companies and consulted into a lot of them as well, that if there is a success for a discovery, then, and I think the correct temptation is to get a bus full of people together and take them all out and have a good time. Rather than just who happened to be sitting on the rig at the time. And the chalcopyrite, chalcocite, sphalerite, galena, native gold, whatever it was pulled to the surface.
I love that. So on a similar note, the author speaks of the rare event and how people often don't reflect enough on them. In our industry, these rare events are otherwise known as outliers, maybe perhaps discoveries. And perhaps we also spend too much time reflecting on them and overanalyzing to the point where we see evidence for them everywhere. What are your thoughts?
Sort of skirted around this issue, I think.
Yeah, we did. Yeah. That's why I went for it.
Yeah, no, sure. I mean, ore deposits, especially significant ones, are weird by definition. And that it's rare to find them. Mm-hmm. And so it's a bit like, and I think the reason you make this point, if you read the book, this is equivalent of someone made $1 million or whatever it was running a business a certain way. Someone finds an ore deposit. We just go and immediately try and replicate what they did to find that ore deposit. Whereas they may have been drilling for something else and just hit it by sheer accident. That would be the directly analogous situation. And we can actually learn nothing from their process of discovery, apart from the fact they drilled a hole, which is a point I can't keep coming back to. They did something at least, and maybe that's an important thing. But I think you just got to look back at them and think, well, what process did they follow? What was the geological process they identified which allowed them to make the discovery? With different things, sorry, not what process did they follow. They're entirely different things. What did they find out from their airborne geophysics, from their mapping, from the geomorphology, from the stream sediments? Did they go to the right part of a catchment after looking at something? Did they see something in the alteration mineralogy that indicated to them that it was a near miss? Things like that. There were the real learnings are. And then I think the other thing is you can turn around is, the old adage that it's never the people who owned the property in the first place that find the ore deposit. Now, I don't know whether that's actually true or not, but there certainly seem to be a lot of anecdotal evidence that it's the people who have owned the ground for the third, fourth, and fifth time that actually find something. But that would be for a lot of reasons, one of which is three dimensions, again, is depth. I mean, we look at things and we think, geez, that area has been well explored. Well, there's only a few drill holes perhaps have gone past 200, 300 metres. What the hell's underneath that? That's a huge unexplored volume, right? And you can perhaps go back to some of that shallow drilling if it still exists and relook at it and go, well, maybe they're on top of something but didn't recognise it. It's that serendipity thing. They weren't in possession of the knowledge to recognise something and went right past their face, which indicated a success was just over there.
Yeah, I think about that Peruvian deposit again. And just, you're adjacent right to an high sulfidation mine, and you think that you're going to be the company that's going to extend the mine, but just the resource isn't there. The mine next door is not interested in it. And, you see, okay, I got a little scarring, but then you're not looking for something more profound than that. You're not thinking because you're not in necessarily a porphyry copper district. You're not thinking in those terms. You have this mine, you have Yanacocha, you have something like this isn't where your headspace is, but then you come in with this thought that, okay, this is what I'm looking for. And then you just see little sniffs and little hints there and you're like, okay, this could be something. Yeah. I think it has to do with perspective. And I think that's just a great point. Yeah. So you just got to be the fifth person on the rig or the fifth person on a project. So you just got to ask them how many people have come before. And then if you're the fifth, you're going to be the successful story.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the corollary to that discussion, because there's always two sides, is the hardest thing when you're running a program as an exploration geo is when do you go somewhere else? But when do you stop flogging a dead horse? Because there's an opportunity cost as well.
Yep.
You could be prosecuting another two or three properties somewhere else in another country or just up the road in the same belt where the Holy Grail sits, but because you've been distracted by sniffs and farts and things that look a little bit interesting, that you're not, how do you make that call? These are hellishly difficult calls to make.
Yeah. And I think he didn't quite mention it in these terms, but I think we also, as being the geoscience community in general, we get really caught up in dogma, what we should be finding versus keeping an open mind of what could be there based on what we're actually seeing. I don't know, just something to leave there.
another favorite thing I like saying is we do all sorts of things to the rocks, right, to try and understand them. But often tell geologists and especially mining engineers now that the rocks don't give a shit what we think of them. They're just the rocks.
Yeah.
It's up to us to work.
It is indeed. They're not going to tell us that we're wrong necessarily or that we're right for that matter, to be optimistic. Yeah. They're just going to sit there and be like, all right, whatever, guys.
I'm a rock.
Another overarching theme in each chapter is that the world is much more random than we think. And again, we've chatted about this, but where I want to go with this is that it's not to say that geos working in the mining industry, that all our hard work is for naught, but rather all this hard work in the long run can increase our odds of benefiting from randomness. Is this a bleak assessment of the book or of our careers?
I think I went looking for my version of the book, actually, Sam, and I couldn't find it. And I suspect I've lent it to someone to read, as I've done many times over the years. But I think one of the last things he says in the book, and maybe you remember, was if you get to a train station, the train's just leaving, he said, rather than chasing after the train, just let it go. There'll be another one. Relax. Relax. And I thought, yeah, that was pretty good, right? And so just settle down and just understand things. Wait them to come to you. You can view this randomness and get quite nihilistic about it. But if you understand more about what's going on in the world and you're patient, then you've got a better chance of being successful within it than someone that isn't, who lets the randomness upset them, if you like. Randomness begets opportunity, right, as well. So someone who might be, so this is purely, well, in the exploration context, if you understand what this is and the problems it can create, and you see what people have done on an exploration project, and you go, oh, no, they've done X, Y, and Z. I'm looking at that and go, that's just crazy because that's just junk. They've not seen the true signal here in the data. So there begets an opportunity, right? So if someone else is fooled by randomness, doesn't mean you mean that you need to be. So I think it puts it on us to be better explorers personally and for the companies and people we work with to be at least think about this and have it in our mind all the time to not be fooled by it. And the name of the book was Fooled by Randomness, but do your best to be aware of what is random and what is real, what's a true pattern and what's just noise. At least if you're thinking about that, I think you're better placed than the next person to actually make a successful go of an exploration program or anything in your life for that matter.
Profound.
Well, he was the profound one. I mean, he's a bit insufferable. He's very opinionated in the book, of course, as you will have noticed when you're reading it. But
yeah, very nonlinear.
You can't put the damn book down. That's the problem. You keep seeing bits in it and you're going, oh my God. But if you can't see good fortune, if the gift horse is paraded in front of you and you can't see it, then that's on you because someone else will. So that's the other thing. So it's being mentally prepared to be able to see an opportunity really for what it is, because not everyone is.
So then I think that makes our next question very short, because this flows right into this. Our listeners here, we have a lot of young listeners that are interested in working as geochemists in the mining industry. And I was wondering, that did you think that the author's comparison of playing Russian roulette with wealth, that we're likewise gambling to become successful geochemists in such a small niche field? It's worked out for some, but on the whole, there's really too little demand in an unstable industry. So in a way, would it, as he says in the book all the time, would it be better for us to become dentists?
Everyone uses dentists in this way when they write about these sorts of things. It's unfair on dentists, but yeah, you sort of get it. But I just wrote, read your comment in a word, no, not everyone needs to be dead. And Russian roulette with wealth. I mean, what he was talking about there is someone has made it. I mean, some people do make it lucky, but it's random and they don't appreciate it and they think they can repeat it. And the wealth they've made, they destroy, right? Because they ascribe their brilliance to getting it in the first place, whereas actually they were just lucky idiots, if you like. Geochemists, so look, when I started in geochemistry, you're lucky to get a bloody gold assay on a bit of drill core, right? That was about it. So we're in a world now where we're generating, just purely from a geochemical point of view, more data, I mean, orders of magnitude more data than we've ever generated from a geochemical point of view at all different scales. So from the macro to the very, very micro. I'd argue now that there's an argument that geochemistry has never been more important to guide the industry's thought process around using that data, because there is so much data, the industry will get filled by randomness. I can guarantee it, just to use that. But what I mean is that will be flooded with data, but not information. And it will need highly trained, highly skilled people to sift through which will be terabytes of data before long per drill hole, to turn that actually into useful information, which you understand, right? Not a whole bunch of random shit, which people will take and misinterpret and distract themselves. Again, there's layers of logic in here, but I think that the companies and the people who are best placed to understand this stuff will be the people best placed to understand it, and the best companies placed to take advantage of serendipitous effects. So you can guarantee that some companies will have a crack at trying this, that, and that. All of these methods are just spewing out enormous amounts of data, not know what to do with it and move on, right? You could say they've been fooled by randomness in a way, but if someone actually understands the process and what they're doing, come in, look at it, reevaluate it, open themselves up to a serendipitous event and say, oh, they actually missed this, which is sitting here. There's real information here. We'll go and drill another hole. Thank you very much. Yeah, we don't need to be dentists, right? There is still a world where the geochemists need to prosecute the data in that way. And so go right back to the start, Sam, and saying that basic background in maths, again, I know maths, but maths, fundamental chemistry, even a bit of geophysics, mineralogy, ore forming processes, a really good fundamental understanding of those things and some field experience will make people who are able to look at this data invaluable. So now's the time, right, really, to be a numerate geoscientist. I think the world should be the oyster for numerate geoscientists, but being an old crusty bugger myself, it's still important that geoscientists get out and spend that time in the bush, in the field, understanding how the data is collected, the difficulties around it, the compromises in the sample collection process, what the samples go through before they end up in front of the machine that goes ping in the corner. It's very important to have a complete understanding of all of those things before someone's let loose on just a geochemical database. But the right training will bring about serendipitous events. And I think that the opportunity in that space will increase a lot in the next 10 years as the industry is flooded by data that it doesn't really know what to do with.
I like that. And I think that's some really valid points in there. And I think also for all our listeners, it gives them hope. I have a lot of people that's, how do I get a job here? How do I do this? How do I do that? I remember looking at a lot of things, job postings, 10 years experience, 15 years, this, that, and the other thing. And I think it's really overwhelming, especially as a new graduate. But I think if you follow Dave's steps for success in here throughout the entire interview, I think that you have a better chance. And I think that also just upon graduating, maybe as a millennial, I didn't expect for the world to be handed to me. I knew that I had to put in the work in. And I'm not hating on you, Gen Z, but I'm also saying, guys, like, you do have to go to the field. You do have to get in some of your initial years in before people are going to start to consider you, because these data sets are complicated and you do have to understand the geology behind them, because having the geology in context to your interpretation of your geochemical data is essential. Otherwise, it's just stats and not necessarily and, do anything.
And you'll have a blast.
Yes, I did have some great times in the field.
In hindsight. A lot of it in hindsight, of course, Sam, but...
Yeah.
But it's all character forming, but I mean, that normally comes out in a negative connotation, but it's not. It's all teaching you about how the world operates, life, work, different cultures. I mean, if you get in the right company doing this sort of work, you'll get exposed to all sorts of environments and cultures and languages, ways of doing work. And I think right at the start, there's no such thing as useless information. And all of that would be amazingly valuable to you as you just progress through your career and life, not just with work.
And then just to finish out here in our question portion, and I know that I had a lot for you, Dave, but this book was, I mean, I don't know, what was it? 400 pages of of stream of thought, stream of consciousness.
I bet there isn't a day goes past now, Sam, without you thinking about something in that book.
Oh my goodness. I had to take a massive break from this book. But yeah, no, there is a lot that comes up when I think about some regular everyday things. Black swans. So at the end of the book, the author sums up traits of market fools, which we've chatted a little bit about, including loyalty to their positions, no game plan in the face of losses, and tendency to change their story based on what's happening. What do you think would be a sum of traits of improper use of geochemical data, and how can we as geochemists work towards ending these practices?
Well, take control of the narrative. So if you are the geochemist or the geoscientist with a strong bent in geochemistry in your company or work environment, don't let the narrative get out of control. Just take control of it, because it is easy to misuse geochemical data. Geochemistry suffers from one thing, and that everyone, which geophysics suffers from less, and that is that most geoscientists would regard themselves as being completely adequate amateur geochemists. And that's been some people listen to this podcast nodding and some will be furious, but that has led to a lot of problems with geochemistry and design of sampling programs and interpretation of data, etc. If you're the geochemist, make sure you understand the process and put your voice in the room, right? Simple things, designing stream sediment programs, catchment sizes, soil sampling programs, what should we do with this drill core, what's the use of mineralogy, all of these things, right? You just need to be equipped to have the arguments to make sure they're done properly, really. And the last thing I wrote down there, Sam, is for geochemists and really for the interpretive geoscientists, if you like, the people who are running around looking at this data, and I think this is really important, is there's still an art involved in looking at data like this. You're still joining the theoretical with the spatial, which is a thing unique to our science. Does require, it is an art form, and the ability to be able to see in 3D and then 4D, so 3D and then layer time and time process on top of that, is just something that is just completely not understood whatsoever outside our industry. So, I mean, if there's some advice for some of the younger listeners here, I would say just develop an aptitude and an art for observation, mathematics, and logical reasoning, and you'll be good if you stick to that.
Very profound. I want to thank you, Dave. I'm still digesting the book. Now this conversation, I think we'll have many things to chat about in the years to come at conferences, I am sure.
We will cross paths somewhere.
Indeed. I want to thank you so much for being here. And I hope that everyone out there listening got at least some new perspectives on geochemical data sets and the mining industry from the standpoint of randomness. I want to thank you all for listening to Geochemist Tea, and a big thanks to Dave Lowy for stopping by the show, dishing some tea, and taking on this philosophical journey. Thanks to our sponsor, LKI Consulting, and to It's Water and Coma Media for our music. And I look forward to chatting with y'all next month.
Thank you, Sam. I'll see you around the chats.